Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. And this morning, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Carl Stefan Boutillet from Ghent University on a very new, very recent publication, hot off the presses, Dialogue and Doxography in Indian Philosophy. Hello, Carl, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Raj. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, my pleasure. So, why don't you tell us a little bit about maybe the publication series that this is part of? I think that would be quite relevant.
Yeah, well, the book is published at Routledge in the series Dialogues in South Asian Traditions, Religion, Philosophy, Literature, and History. And actually, I feel that the topic of the book is quite appropriate for the series. And that was also the idea of the one of the series director. I'm pretty happy about it because I feel it's a series that has published quite a number of great titles. So I'm very humbled to be part of it.
Actually, I felt sort of the same way. I had the good fortune of publishing with Routledge both books now. The other one's out this week. Maybe at some point I'll do a flip interview on that one. But it is humbling. It's quite a quite a respected publisher. And so your book is part of a series on dialogue. You know, before we even get into the book, you know, there may be readers, listeners out there who, however educated, may be slightly stumped by the word doxography. And they may need to go look up doxography. So how about you tell us what doxography is and perhaps how it applies to your research and how it informs your research and perhaps even how your research informs the use of that term.
Yeah, well, that's a good idea to begin with. That obviously doxography is not a common word. We're more used to the term perhaps biography, right? Perhaps we can relate to the two terms. Like a biography is normally somehow of a retelling of a bios, right? The telling of a life story. Whereas a doxography is, let's say, a text or a content of a text which focuses on doxa, so on opinion, views, especially in the Indian context. It's what we call doxographies are somehow compilations of views or parts of texts or full text again that discuss what the Sanskrit term darshana mainly covers, right? So, I mean, there are other terms with a similar semantic, but often actually doxographies in the Indian context have darshana in their title. Now, what exactly is a doxography? That's part of the job here in the book to elucidate that. The term itself, doxography, was coined by Diels, Hermann Alexander Diels, if I remember properly, a German classicist. So the term was coined to denote, I would say, mainly, text or parts of text found quite profusely in the Greco-Roman world, although there are doxographies that are Islamic and Christian. So mainly when we say, if we identify a single text as a doxography, it would be a text in which you will find a list of different views. But then they have so many different kinds of doxographies, and it's kind of part of the debate now in the field. Shall we use a narrow view on doxography, or shall we use a broader view? Andrew Nicholson, I think, did a very good job already in discussing doxography. He opted for adopting a narrow view. So he would say text that discuss views without too much argument, right? It's kind of a mere listing of views. And I think that was perhaps useful for his own work, but I have adopted a broader definition of doxography. So I have given in the book quite a formal definition of what I understand by doxography, but perhaps we need not here to get into those formalities. But let's say that it's either a whole text or a part of a text where competing views of philosophers or different schools are presented, right, following a certain division of topics and so forth. Now, these texts have often been viewed rather negatively in the Indian context. They have been blamed of being inaccurate very often, they have also been used, I find, in a more historiographical manner. So scholars use these texts sometimes to date some philosophical contents and so forth, to try to say, well, okay, if that text comes from that period and talks about this particular view, then we might deduce that that view was in vogue at that time and so forth. And although this is something that we can do, obviously, with doxography, I try to do something else, and I view them in a rather different manner. For me, these texts were not meant to be historiographical, but they are dialectical and have a rhetorical, let's say, a rhetorical approach. And they all have a structure of their own and so forth. And this leads me to see these texts as perhaps practical texts, as having what I call a spiritual dimension. So they can be seen as spiritual exercises. And this is, I believe, quite a new approach to such literature.
So tell us specifically which literature, which texts, which views. Maybe you can talk about the organization of the book a little bit while you answer that.
Well, so for that book, when it started, I thought I could work on 5 different texts. But then this would have made a very big, very big book and a lot of research. And what I decided is to focus on 3 different texts coming out of 3 different sectarian context. So I've used, the first text that I used to launch the book, right? It's the 6th century text from Bhaviveka, a Buddhist Madhyamika philosopher. The text is the Madhyamika Hridayakarika, so the heart of the middle way. Then the second text is actually quite well known. This time is a Jain text of the about 8th century, the Shaddarshana Samuchaya from Haribhadra Suri. And the third text is perhaps more problematic because of its authorship, which is it's not obvious to figure it out. The third text is the Sarva Siddhanta Sangraha, attributed to Shankara. And the datation of that text is also not obvious. So let's say that the Advaita tradition tries to say it's from Shankara. So then we could say, well, it's from the time of Shankara, but it's most likely a text from minimum of perhaps 10th, 11th century. and perhaps as late as 14th century. So this is still a contentious topic. So these are the three texts that I work on, but I could not work on these old texts altogether, because the MHK, for example, the Majjhimika Hridayakarika, is enormous. So I had to focus on chapters. And I selected one chapter of each text. So I took each chapter on the Mimamsa view. And that, I believe, gave some coherence to the book as well. And there are several reasons why I selected that chapter of each of the texts. One of them, perhaps, which I found very compelling, is that since I am trying to show that these texts have, a practical dimension, right, that these texts can be seen as spiritual exercises, I'm locating these exercises within, a philosophical yoga, or in more, Sanskrit term, I try to show or to locate these texts as a practice that is meaningful in the context of jnana yoga, right? The yoga of knowledge. And so when I choose the Mimamsa chapter, here it's interesting because Mimamsa is often associated with, the karma yoga to the performance of sacrifices. And there is a kind of opposition often between the promoters of the path of knowledge and the path of action. So I try in the book as well to illustrate that opposition somehow. And so in each of the chapter, I come back a bit and see where this path of knowledge and how it is promoted and how it makes sense. So I would say that each of these three authors could define their approach, or at least their philosophical approach, as a form of jnana yoga. Yeah. So that's about it in terms of what texts I engage with. Primarily, because obviously I have to discuss a bunch of other texts on the side, but these three are the main focus.
Could you tell us a little bit about how you engage the texts?
Right. The book in itself, I think, should be somehow visualized as a plant somehow, right? It grows and the stem, let's say, right, has three components, and out of the tree comes different branches. So depending on each text, there are some different elements of focus in the chapter. But first, I try to locate each of the texts in their sectarian context. So I will talk about Majjhimika, for example, and the author by Viveka, what is his Majjhimika approach, and how is doxography meaningful in that sectarian context. That's become quite important to read the text. And I do the same for each other text. So I try for the Shaddarshana Samuchaya to locate this doxography within the the sectarian environment of Jainism, and I try to here elucidate what's the need here of a doxography, how can it contribute, and how can doxography be a spiritual exercise in the context of Jainism. And then I do the same with Advaita. So that's a main branch. I also try to read in the context. I try to read the text not only as spiritual exercise, which would kind of perhaps essentialize, these texts as being merely spiritual, but I want to somehow relate the text to the political, environment, so the socio-historical context, which somehow influence the development of doxography. especially in the MHK chapter, so the chapter on Bhaviveka's doxography. I give a longer, perhaps historiographical context in trying to elucidate the development of apologetics and of debate and competition between different schools. How did that come to be? Yeah, especially focusing, let's say, from the 5th, 6th century onwards, where we see new development in heuristic and so forth. So that's another main component that I somehow discuss in each chapter. And then perhaps a third of the main components, which is related, yeah, to the nature of the content of those doxographies. So these doxographies that I explained before, they list views. And so I try to reflect on what are views and why are views important, for philosophy, obviously, but why are people who are engaged on a religious path, let's say in Buddhism or in Advaita or in Jainism, why is it meaningful for them to engage with views and what are, you know, why do they have not only to learn their own views, but why do they pay attention to the views of others? And this somehow leads me to discussion of, let's say, this principle of the conventional views against ultimate views. And I somehow suggest that, you know, all the views listed in doxographies are always to be taken as conventional views. And it is through this kind of, say, dialectic of engaging with competing conventional views that the doxographies are trying to direct the practitioner, let's say here the philosopher or the thinker, the public, the reader of that text. So these texts are trying to engage the practitioner towards the ultimate view, right? And it's in that sense that I suggest that these texts can be seen as spiritual exercise. So they make use of conventional views, to repeat, in order to establish somehow an ultimate view. So that would be three kind of theoretical components that come back in each section. But then, yeah, each section has more, I would say, little leaves and flowers and branches touching on other topics. For example, one which I try with Bhaviveka's text, by the end of the chapter, I discuss irony and humor in Bhaviveka. And this is a topic which I felt was really seldom discussed by philosophers, people who study Indian philosophy, perhaps because we tend to be too serious. I don't know why, but whereas we find a lot of discussion, for example, in classical studies with Socrates and so forth, on irony and, you know, the function of irony and humor in philosophy, there's very little about it in Indian philosophy. And in Bhaviveka, at the end, I kind of touch upon it because I actually see a lot of irony in Bhaviveka's work, and I wanted to illustrate that a little bit and reflect on its function, perhaps, and why do we see that here?
Yeah. So why would you say, I think I agree with you in terms of the general trend, but why would you say that it's sort of against the trend to note irony and humor in these works? Like, what would you say is at play in terms of trends in scholarship that you are sort of shifting with your ironical read?
Well, I don't know here if I'm like shifting a trend or, well, when I discovered irony in Bhaviveka's work, then I started to look around. So is there people theorizing irony in Indian philosophy? And I found practically nothing. So I would say one of the reasons why I'm saying this is because I've been looking for people who actually engage with this topic, and there is not much on it. But then if we reflect on why is that so, well, that's actually a pretty good question. I guess that should be a discussion on its own, perhaps because a lot of the approach, you know, perhaps we could take that line of inquiry. A lot of the approach that are taken are philologically oriented, right? So they, you know, kind of break the text in pieces and focus on small elements here and there. Or again, if it's, let's say, a philosopher, not a philologist who's engaging with text, often the philosophers themselves, they focus on, let's say, a topic, yeah, the self, or, you know, epistemology and so forth, which kind of breaks the text apart again and then tries to isolate, yeah, the topic and go into the logical technicalities of that topic. Whereas I think to see humor, we have to take the text more as a whole, as units. And then we see perhaps like patterns here more clearly when the text is not just broken down. And when we see that text is meant to talk to people, is meant to not only seduce people with rational argument, but as well with, let's say, more psychological methods, yeah, rhetoric and so forth. So I don't know, yeah, these are just suggestions. But what I know for sure is that the idea of irony and humor in Indian philosophy hasn't been much explored so far. And I am only sketching, an attempt in the book because that's not the main focus.
Well, part of the reason I sort of take us to this footnote of the main purpose of your project to talk about parts of the text that perhaps may have been overlooked in previous scholarship is because, you know, I suspected that it, for the very same reasons why the texts that I look at haven't been read the way I read them, I suspected the same to be true of your texts. I mean, we're both textualists. I look at narrative texts, epics, Puranas, and you look at philosophical texts. But the one key methodological inclination, innovation for me is finding a way to look at the text as a whole before slicing and dicing, because you can often yield a fair bit by the slicing and dicing. But the first step is to look at the text as a whole. And I just suspected it might be similar with your subfield. So I thought I'd just drill down and see if it was the case. So it's interesting that you have the same supposition. Now, more to the heart of your project, there are a couple of terms that you use that I think would be useful to drill down on further. When you talk about the... first, say something about the distinction between the conventional view and the ultimate view that you see, the interplay between the two that you see in the doxographies. And secondly, could you please unpack what you mean by spiritual exercise in this context?
Sure. All right. So, well, perhaps let's begin backwards. I think it would be perhaps easier. Yeah, with the spiritual exercise, what I mean there. I take that term, and I think it is well known now, from Pierre Hadot, right, who was a classicist and work on different Greco-Roman philosophers. His approach to philosophy tried to somehow break away from a previous approach, which were a bit like we said, right, breaking down the text and seeing the text as merely kind of perhaps intellectual formation and then looking for systems and so forth. And he tried to say, well, the people who are doing, who are writing these texts, they are involved in a practice, a certain practice of philosophy which defines their lifestyle, and the text that are spiritual exercise are meaningful in the sense that they contribute to this lifestyle. More especially what is quite meaningful to me, spiritual exercise are meant to somehow bring about a change, a shift in perspective. They are meant to transform views, to inform views as well, but mainly to transform them. And ultimately, by transforming views, right, it is thought that they can transform the practitioner, in that sense here, the philosopher, right? So when I talk of doxographies as spiritual exercise, and I want to denote that they are meant to not only to inform, yeah, but to transform the views. So in that sense, they are never neutral, right? In a sense, they're not just giving some information about views and that's it. And that is perhaps a way that they have been misread. That's something I suggest in the book. But in the past, yeah, people often blame doxographies and doxographers for being inaccurate, for wrongly depicting views and so forth. So in that sense, the critique would say that, well, these doxographies, they are not informing us properly. And that might be the case because, I mean, there are a lot of different problems in the information that doxographies provide. But if we see these texts as not seeking merely to inform, but to transform, then we can start to see that perhaps where there is misinformation, there might be some rhetorical strategy at play here. There might be a reason why there is misinformation. And in that sense, it's not that the doxographer is only, which is possible, but it's not that he is only not well informed, but it is perhaps because he has another project and then he uses his approach to views, yeah, in a certain way to inflect, yeah, perhaps the meaning of some, you know, some ideas in order to direct the reader towards a better idea. Yeah, in the end, I think that I suggest that each doxography suggests a best view. Yeah, and ultimately, now that will lead us to the second topic, but ultimately, they suggest or they try to lead the practitioner in that case here, or in the philosopher, they try to lead him or her to the ultimate view. But what do I mean by conventional and ultimate? Now, this is a common trope, let's say, in Indian philosophies, especially those who seem to adopt what I call the Jnana Marga, the Jnana Yoga, yeah, the path of knowledge. It is a topic that we find in Buddhism, but equally in Jainism and in Advaita. That is why, actually, I use that as well, because I see it there and it makes sense. So what is a conventional view? I would say this is every view, right? Every view that is conceptual, every view that is using words, every view that is laid down on paper, in text, or something that can be understood by different means of reasoning, different pramanas. All of these views, would be said to be conventional. And that is, as I say, in the tree system that I listed, they talk about views and they talk about that other, let's say, that ultimate perspective, that ultimate view for the Buddhists, that would be shunyata, for example, right? The ultimate perspective, which is not a view itself, right? They would say that ultimate view is a non-view. In Jainism, you had Kunda Kunda talking about the distinction between the two views, the conventional and the ultimate. For him, the ultimate is actually the perspective of the soul itself, which is somehow non-conceptual, non-verbal. And similarly, in Advaita, you have Shankara using this para apara vidya, this non-ultimate knowledge. And for him too, let's say the ultimate is Brahman, right? So the ultimate is the perspective of Brahman. But then comes the problem is that how do we get there? How do we establish the ultimate? How do we get to the ultimate perspective when all the means that we have are conventional? And this is where I see actually the meaningfulness of doxography for one thing, but also of philosophy, right? So the question of how to establish the ultimate view brings the question of how to use views, the conventions, how to use philosophy, which, in its rational conceptual dimension is always conventional. So how do we use the conventional to get to the non-conventional? How does that work? And there, in each system, in each sectarian context, you have different strategies that are laid out for that purpose. And I argue that we can see these strategies at play already within doxographies, at least within the doxographies that I have reviewed.
Well, it seems clear to me, just to comment on your earlier point, it seems clear to me that these texts certainly have something to sell in the ancient Indian marketplace of ideas, and that they're engaged in selling what it is they're trying to sell.
Mm-hmm.
And to do so, they're going to upplay or downplay other traditions. You know, they're not, no less so than when you turn on the television in the modern day and look at a news channel, right?
Yes.
Although they are purportedly reporting facts, certainly it's far from only that. There's going to be a spin. There's going to be a perspective, a viewpoint that is being sold, a lens through which the facts are emphasized or de-emphasized. And it just seems intuitive to me that certainly that would be the case for these ancient Indian texts as well. So I'm surprised to hear that they were maybe dismissed as inaccurate representations in earlier stages of scholarship.
Yes, well, that is likely due to the fact that people who actually looked at doxographies looked at it for some, they looked at those doxographies for their contents, more than for the text as a whole, right? And they will kind of break the text apart and say, well, this idea doesn't fit in that context here, or this is not, or something is missing, and so forth. And so the texts were not considered, I think, as a full unit. Yet to come back to what you said, say that each system or each doxographer has something to sell. I think the analogy here with marketing is more than a metaphor. I think really somehow these doxographies have a marketing strategy. And I am inclined here to tell you a story that came to me once. I was in Dublin and I was visiting the Jameson whiskey distillery with my wife. It was after Christmas, we were visiting around, and they gave us a tour of that distillery. And at the end, they gave us a degustation, right? A tasting of different whiskeys. And I thought it was very interesting how they had set up that tasting, because it immediately reminded me of one type of doxography that I was dealing with in my work. Because what they did is that they gave us three different whiskeys. And there was one that was a Jameson, but there was also the whiskeys of two competitors. So there was one, it was a red label. They started by giving us a red label whiskey, then a Jameson whiskey, and then they gave us a Jack Daniels, if I remember properly. And they gave us, with every whiskey, a little bit of information, which was very systematic. It would be where it comes from, how it's made, and its price. And then you would see actually that the two first ones, let's say the red label and the Jameson's, are rather similar in taste, but the red label is actually more expensive, whereas Jameson is more affordable. And then you would move on to the Jack Daniels, and then you would see that it is quite cheap, but it also doesn't taste very good, at least in the context here of the people. So you see that they were systematically using their competitors to illustrate, to kind of sell their own product. And I thought that's very fascinating. But that is here doxography used for whiskey marketing. And this idea of putting, let's say, the Jameson in the middle recalled to me actually the strategy at play in the Jaina doxography that I am evaluating in the book that I'm analyzing the Shatdarshana Samuchaya, which I argue there that what Haribhadra is doing is he is putting his system in the middle, in between, you know, different competitors, and there are clear signs that he is suggesting that his is the best. Yeah. Anyway, so I find the
mic. If I wasn't muted just now, you would hear me laugh out loud. It's a great story, and I think it's sort of an intoxicating metaphor, pun intended, for this. So I had the good fortune for a semester of teaching at Ryerson University. It's a very, very urban university in an extremely diverse city of Toronto. And I taught world religions. And at the outset of the class, I said, you know, we are going to look at the world religions in the marketplace of ideas. What are they each selling you? What is it going to cost you? What is their value proposition? Is it worth it to you to invest in them? And they really resonated with that approach. So it just makes me laugh thinking of some of the conversations I had in that class. But that's a great example, and it's a great marketing strategy. Actually, I've never taken a business course in my life, but in 2015 I started entrepreneuring so I could teach and stay in Toronto and teach online, teach in person, and do one-on-one coaching. And so I've learned a thing or two over the years. And apparently, when someone makes you three offers. In a sales context, it's the middle one they want you to take. they'll give you one that's like, if you want to, I don't usually use these strategies because generally people find me through word of mouth. Yeah. A friend or colleague will have a great experience and then they'll decide to refer me. But, I'll say, you can coach for me for one session and it'll cost you this, or you can coach with me for like a month and it'll cost you this, or you can coach with me for a year and it'll cost you this. And really it's the month I'm trying to sell you. It's the middle one, right?
Yeah, I get it.
I find that fascinating. So tell us about, tell us about some of the unique, differences among the other two case studies you looked at.
Yeah.
Tell us about how these are quite different as well.
All right. So actually, the book itself starts with the MHK, I said, right? So the Bhavivekas text is Majjhimika text, Majjhimika Hridayakarika. And then the second is Shatdarshana Samuchaya. And the third is Sarva Siddhanta Sangraha. And there's also a reason why I chose this kind of progression, because actually, it's the dialectical strategies at play here, the teleology of the text. By teleology, I mean the order of presentation of views. It's kind of coherent. So if we look at the MHK, what I'm suggesting here when we take the text as a whole is that Bhavivekas starts by presenting views that are Buddhist. Well, first of all, the first three chapters, especially the third one, kind of make a unit. But the third one here presents different categories of Abhidharma Buddhism. And Bhavivekas somehow presents and criticizes this category to show his own perspective, which is the no view of Majjhimika, right? Majjhimika tries to kind of grind to pieces normally every kind of view to show that they don't have inherent nature, that nothing has svabhava. So in order to establish this kind of non-view, the view of the void, if you want, Bhavivekas here presents different topics of Abhidharma, and that somehow shows his own position without naming it, right? Without saying this is me or something like this, right? So there's no like chapter that says Majjhimika view. No, it doesn't work like this. You have these kind of first three chapters that establish, let's say, the perspective of Bhavivekas by emptying out the categories of Abhidharma. And after that, you have two more schools of Buddhism. And afterwards, you would have the different, Hindu school like Samkhya and so forth. And the last one, it's the one I was working on, the Mimamsa. And here I suggest that the strategy actually is that the further you away you stand from the initial position. So the further away you are from the first three chapters, the further you are from truth. So it's kind of a descent into absurdity. That's the words I use in the book. So that is the kind of method, the dialectic and the teleology of the MHK, I suggest. It's kind of a descent into a doctrinal absurdity. And here, Bhaviveka is a bit like the philosopher in Plato's cave. He kind of, go back in the cave and takes you wherever you are, you know, in the darkness, and tries to lift you back up, you know, to light, let's say, by destroying the arguments of each of these, each of the presented system, right? So if you understand me, that here the dialectic is kind of a descent into absurdity. Then the second text, the Jaina text, you have, this has been discussed by quite many scholars. And interestingly, most scholars have tended to say that there is no strategy in the Darsana Samuchaya, that is just a random display of view, and that is supposedly because of the Anekanta Vada principle of Jainism. So he just sees all these views more or less as, you know, equal, and he randomly presents them. But that's actually not the fact. It's called this, a compendium of six views, but in fact there are seven. And the fourth one is the Jaina one, which makes three views before and three views after. And also the views of Haribhadra, the view of Jainism, is the only one that is presented with a kind of praise, you know, praise of the Jina and so forth. So it's clear that that is the best view. Now I have a series of other arguments that I believe will be criticized, and rightly so. I have different means to suggest that. But in any case, I say that I see the strategy at play here in Haribhadra's text is to present his view as the center of world philosophy, kind of Mount Meru, of philosophical position. It is the central station, and to occupy that central position in Jainism is not random, I suggest. It is actually desirable. It's the best position one can have. In order to prove that, then, as I say, I have different arguments. But so here the idea is kind of an idea of equanimity. Each views are, let's say, equal, from a conventional perspective. But Samyak Darshana, the best view is only the view of the Jina. And one should somehow get that point. And by adopting the view of the Jina, then one can can somehow get to the ultimate perspective, which is beyond views altogether. So to repeat, the MHK of Bhaviveka, it's the best view is at the beginning. In Haribhadra, the best view is in the middle. And then with the Pseudo Shankara or the Sarvasiddhanta Sangraha, the best view, the view of the Advaita, stands at the end, right? So here we have a progression where each view somehow is kind of, each first view is negated by the second. And slowly we progress from the gross to the subtle. Now, this is interesting as well, because the people who have talked about such a schematic in the Advaita have sometimes compared this method with, I think that was here, Andrew Nicholson, who compared that method to the dialectic in, I think he said, Hegel, if I remember, in any case. Whereas actually what I'm trying to highlight here is that strategy, this idea of going from the gross to the subtle, where each new view kind of enlarge the perspective of the previous one, is actually a pedagogic strategy that we find already in the teachings of Shankara when he comments on different Upanishads and so forth. So that was noted by Jacqueline Hirst, for example, are different scholars. So this pedagogic strategy is really in tune with the, let's say, the teaching of the Advaita, with the pedagogy of the Advaita. So it's somehow natural to see it repeated within the Sarvasiddhanta Sangraha. So if you heard me well, I would say that each of these strategies, yeah, of each of these texts reflect actually the pedagogy or the propedeutic of the different system that built these views, that built these doxographies. And I think that is perhaps a surprise, you know, if we're, it's interesting when we see it at first, but it is actually most probable. It's coherent somehow. And also it suggests that there are no doxographies, or at least these three doxographies are not neutral. Doxographies are always a form of marketing, if you want to take that metaphor.
Well, the observation that you make regarding the structure of the text, I think it's profound that these texts are organized in these ways. I study very different texts. My entire thesis actually was based on what I can learn about the Devi Mahatmya based on its structure first, looking at the first thing and the last thing and the middle thing. That's just a methodological strategy that I had so internalized. It took me quite some time to actually put it into words and connect it with Mary Douglas's work on ring composition, the sort of pervasive compositional strategy, probably preliterate. We don't know where it's there and back again, right? The first connects with the last. The middle is more important, right? So I won't say too much about that at this point. But this is it is clear to me that there is a profound interplay between content and form in ancient Indian, particularly Sanskrit texts.
Yes, go ahead, sorry.
No, it's fine. They're orchestrated in such a way so as to guide exegesis, or at least aim to do so by their very structure. I think we should look at the text as a meaningful whole first, regardless. But I think especially given how the profound interplay between content and form with these texts, we do a great disservice to our search for knowledge through these texts when we dismiss that orchestration and then proceed to look at bits and pieces of the texts.
Yeah, indeed. Actually, that's this. I was even tempted to say that when it comes at least to doxography, to take that saying from his name escapes me, this famous Canadian theorician of communication, where it says that the medium is the message, right? That's McLuhan, I think, exactly. So I think in doxography, the medium is the message more than the particulars. Although the particulars are interesting, it's really the medium here that it, like, somehow informs, the play, how things are to happen. But more than a formal characteristic, I think we can also reflect back on these patterns within each sectarian context to somehow gain an insight on how they perceive their position in the world, how they interacted with others. And this is where perhaps there is more, a notion here of dialogue and so forth. So how did they use others somehow to portray themselves? How did they relate with otherness? But also, how did they perceive themselves, right? And it is especially clear in the case of the Advaita text, when you have a group of people who put themselves really at the top of the ladder somehow, you have here a very strong claim that might reverberate beyond the spiritual world to impact the political world as well. Yet, to be fair, each of these authors and each of these systems perceive themselves as the best, but they will express it differently. And these nuances have consequences, as I said, beyond the mere philosophical world. There is here, I would like to explore that more. I try in the book to, reflect on that a little bit. But there seems to be a whole set of coherences here between, let's say, the sacred and the profane, the spiritual and the political.
And so maybe this is a good point to ask what next, what more? How would you like to continue this research?
All right. There's just so many ways, right? One could continue. So I could go on looking at other doxographies, and that's something I suggest in the conclusion, right? That people perhaps should do further research and seeing different types of strategies that exist. Now I've outlined three, but perhaps there is more, or perhaps within the same sectarian environment, for example, within Jainism. Perhaps there are different strategies that are used by doxographers, and what does that tell us, and so forth. So these are ways that one can go. However, for now, I decided to not engage with that immediately, because I wanted to somehow have a bit of fresh air and touch upon new material. But I continue somehow with the idea of lists. So doxographies are a list of lists. All right, so you have a list of views, a list of darshanas, or a list of philosophical systems, which are presented as list of topics. For example, list of darshanas and list of whatnot that constitute somehow these views. And the whole idea of lists and making lists captured my attention, and I wanted to go back in time rather than to move forward and try to find other doxographies when there are plenty of other ones, but rather than go on further in time and examining further doxographies, I wanted to go back in time at the idea of making lists itself. So what is the relation of these doctrinal lists to philosophies? What is the relation of learning all these doctrinal content, the relation of that to one spiritual, path, one spiritual journey? So I started to reflect on the list making itself as a spiritual exercise, as a contemplative practice. And this can be very broad. For those who read in Indian philosophy, will know that almost every text is a list of lists, and there are just an endless amount of lists. So one could, approach this topic in so many ways. And this is what I'm doing at Ghent. That is the project for which I'm funded by the FWO. As of right now, I am using lists as a way to reflect on rituals, and I am prone to see lists as a ritualization of knowledge. And I want to theorize, a passage from a time where ritual was quite dominant in the social religious sphere of India, to a time where we have now, systematic philosophies, or what we exactly call darshanas, right? And I want to look at this kind of passage from, more ritual life to a more speculative life through the topic of list. And now it perhaps seems quite up in the air, and that's something else in the book, so I don't want to engage too long on that. But there's a lot of what one can do. I even every day now, I try, based on my reading and reflection, I post some photos on Instagram or snippets of thought related to list and list making and so forth. So if our listeners want to go on my Instagram and have a look, and they can see a different reflection that this can bring about. But really, so I'm interested in that idea that actually, when we talk of Indian philosophy, and especially of philosophy as a spiritual practice, we are actually looking at how knowledge is formed and to transform. And here a list becomes very important because lists come about as, let's say, ritualized forms that are meant to be incorporated, that are meant to be transformed. And then ultimately we will see that these lists and these forms are, let's say, mapping out the conventional world, and some will suggest that they have to be relinquished, they have to be abandoned in order for the ultimate view, somehow the ultimate perspective to dawn on oneself. So that's also fascinating. Here we have, let's say, a pedagogy that teaches an endless amount of lists, ultimately to suggest that we have to let go of all these lists. And I find that fascinating. So I'm writing now and researching around that topic as a kind of continuity from doxography, for these methods and these engagement with lists will ultimately become, yeah, the content of doxographies.
Well, that's certainly fascinating. And at this stage of any project, it should be up in the air. It should be expansive. It should be creative. It should, you shouldn't so limit or curtail your thought process right now. That certainly sounds like an idea worth pursuing, and it'd be interesting to see what comes of it. And should you publish a subsequent book, and should I still be doing this work, then we'll have to interview on that as well.
I was most happy. Yeah, certainly.
So you mentioned your Instagram account. I am embarrassingly, I'm a social media novice. I literally joined Twitter last month. I think it was to help promote something for Penguin. So why don't you give folks your Instagram handle?
Oh, yes. You mean verbally? Yeah.
Sure. Why not? I'll list it as well. But there are those who may well come to the website. But for example, for those who get this podcast through Apple,
yeah,
or something,
yeah, no problem.
I'll be listed.
So what I did is I kind of make an anagram with my name. So it's KXB, and then with an underscore list with a S. So KXB underscore lists in plural. That's my Instagram name. By the way, I'm quite new to all of this as well. It's actually my wife who convinced me to give it a shot and see how I like it. And then I grew very fond of it. I'm using photos of my previous travels and life in India. I stayed in India for quite a few years, and I have quite a data bank of images that I use for these photos. And I try to make more recent ones as well. Europe and so forth.
Sounds great. So for those of you listening, once again, we have been speaking with Dr. Carl Stefan Aboutiet from Ghent University on his very recent publication. And now I don't have the publication title handy. It's Dialogue and Doxography in Indian Philosophy. For those of you out there, stay safe, keep reading, keep thinking, keep listening. Take care until next time.